Chili Effect is sponsored by WallStreetWindow.com and listeners like you.
And now the most underrated voice in all media, Chuck O'Shelly.
February 8, 2023, allegedly, according to that thing we call a calendar. And this is the show you were looking for. How do I know that? Because you're hearing me say this. Anyway, Woden's Day, Wednesday, the middle of the week, that's for sure. And keeping in step with what has gone on thus far on the network this week, I'm really happy to have an unusual guest for me. Not so unusual, though. You know, he was on the Jack Blood Show not too long ago. And, hey, that's happened a couple of times recently where I heard a guest on there while I was producing and said to myself, this would be a good guest for me to talk to. And you know you're going to get a different discussion. Because Jack and I, not really seeing eye to eye. We sound different, that's for sure. I'm happy to produce this show, but yeah, I talk to people differently than Jack does. That's just a fact. And this gentleman's interesting for a whole bunch of reasons, okay? Not only is he a well-educated man, for sure. I think there's a PhD after his name and all that. Teaches at Ramapo, on, and we could get into that and probably will. But why is this oddly interesting to me? I think I voted for him at one point. Okay. I lived in New Jersey, as you all well know, and you can tell from my accent. But anyway, yeah, I think I did. I'm pretty sure I did, because somewhere in the 90s, Murray Sabrin is with me. Murray, when did you run for governor around that time period in the 90s?
It was 1997, it was a great opportunity to get the libertarian ideas out to the general public in the state of New Jersey, and I became the first third-party candidate to achieve a milestone in New Jersey politics. We raised enough money to qualify for the matching funds from the State Election Commission, and it was a struggle, but we did it, and I was entitled, I was required to be in three debates with the two major party candidates, mm-hmm. Governor Whitman, the incumbent Republican, and her Democratic challenger, State Senator and Mayor of Woodbridge, New Jersey, Jim McGreevy, who went on to win the governorship 4 years later. But I was there toe-to-toe, mano-a-mano, and discussing how we could make New Jersey a libertarian state. And unfortunately, I didn't win, and I have to tell you, Chuck, if you voted for me and you didn't vote for me twice or three times, you didn't do your duty in New Jersey, which is multiple voting is sort of a sport in New Jersey.
Well, look, I didn't know much at the time. Full disclosure, right? I was, let's think about this. I was 25, okay? And I was a musician in New Jersey, so politics was not my main focus, okay? I was more about art at the time. And, frankly, I've recounted on this show, it sounds strange, but I voted for Bill Clinton. That was the first presidential candidate I voted for. And I've been all over the map, but the only party I've ever registered under is Libertarian. Otherwise, I have registered as an independent anywhere else I've been. And frankly, by the time you did it a couple of times, I probably had already given up in New Jersey on voting. And that's the truth. I'm being blunt with you. I recognize, and I saw the Libertarian Party at that time, right? When I first really got to enter into the debate and had the power to vote and all that, I turned 18 in 1990, right? So I think it was 92 was the first presidential election I had a chance to vote in, something like that. And Clinton was the guy I cast a ballot for. Now, if you looked at the rest of my ballot, you would have been confused. I didn't flip all the switches in one place, right? And we had those voting machines with the places there. I'm pretty sure I voted in Ocean Grove, New Jersey, first time. And I flipped those switches, and they were all over the place. A lot of the local candidates that I liked what they had to say, I didn't care about what their party affiliation was. It didn't matter if it was for a freeholder or if it was for governor or whatever else. I tried to follow the messages. What does this individual have to say? I don't care about their party. But I will say that one of the only parties that attracted me philosophically, even at that time, was the Libertarian Party. And it is very different in my mind today to say that you're a libertarian and to be libertarian today than it was at that time. Now, that's one of the things I want to talk to you about today. I also want to ask you some questions about your area of expertise in my mind, which is economics, okay? Because straight rational discussion about the circumstance we're in is awfully rarefied, okay, Murray? And he told me to call him Murray off air before we started, by the way. And so that's why I'm calling him Murray. He's not my, you know, we're not buddies. We've only talked a couple of times and all that, but I really do appreciate you. And I'm sure I voted for you once. I didn't know you could vote more than once in Jersey. I guess I wasn't so well informed. Seemed pretty tough to even vote once, actually, in Jersey, where I was in Ocean Grove, but story for another day. So let's attack this. Libertarian then and libertarian now. That's you. Am I right or wrong?
Well, actually, I became a philosophical libertarian in the early 70s when I read an article in the Sunday New York Times magazine written by two Columbia University students about libertarianism, the philosophy of libertarianism. And in the article was a profile of Ayn Rand, who never called herself a libertarian. Mm-hmm. She called her philosophy objectivism. And there was a profile of Murray Rothbard, who I knew nothing about. He was a college professor, an author. And then a few months later, I read an article by him in the New York Times, flying back from Italy after Nixon did wage price controls. And he wrote an op-ed in the New York Times called The President's Economic Betrayal. And he just outlined why Nixon's economic policy is going to be a disaster, which it turned out to be, because when you have wage price controls, you get distortions in the economy, which means that you either have surpluses or shortages. And sure enough, when you have maximum price controls, which is what price controls usually do, you get shortages, and they showed up right away. And that eventually led to the oil crisis of 1973-74. And so I was already attuned to the libertarian philosophy, having read Milton Friedman in Newsweek magazine in the 1960s when I was an undergraduate, where he talked about free markets and how they're best for the economy, that they would provide the goods and services people want, and how government intervention undermines economic freedom and prosperity. And so I was already starting to get a feel that the Great Society, Keynesian view of the world, where government is supposed to spend and tax and regulate and print up money by the Federal Reserve, is supposed to be the formula, if you will, the recipe for prosperity. And we've seen time and time again, when the government keeps on doing this, the economy does not function at its or operate at its optimal capacity. What that means is that in a free market economy, Chuck, prices reflect supply and demand, and entrepreneurs are in the business of putting together the resources to produce goods that people want. And so their job is to try to forecast consumer demand. That's why marketing is such an important aspect of a free market economy, because you have to have information about consumers' wants so you can plan for the future. And the government just upsets that that situation by taxes and spending and regulation. So libertarianism, to me, is just a natural philosophy that you find in the Declaration of Independence. If you read the Declaration of Independence, it talks about the natural rights of human beings. And what are those natural rights? Life, liberty, and the pursuit of happiness. Mm-hmm. And then you have the Constitution, the Bill of Rights, which says, what is the proper relationship between the government and the citizenry? And it's basically just leaving the people alone to pursue their own goals in a peaceful manner, and all will be good. You don't need to have government micromanaging the economy, picking winners and losers through the tax code, giving subsidies here and subsidies there. Just allow the marketplace to unfold, and you'll have prosperity for the greatest amount of people. As long as you develop your skills, you will find a job in a free market economy. And so the thing I used to tell my students when I taught finance is that this was my fifth career. I started as a New York City school teacher. I worked on a financial newsletter. I worked as a staff economist at a think tank, and then worked for their investment subsidiary as portfolio manager, then I worked in commercial real estate. So I have a lot of, have had a lot of opportunities in different fields. And then eventually the job came up at Ramapo College teaching finance, and they hired me on a temporary basis, which turned into a tenure track position and a 35-year career until I retired in June of 2020. So when I was teaching finance, that's not a economics per se, but you bring in ideas that come from economics and finance about how the economy works and how business decision makers have to use these tools that they have regarding putting together plans, financial planning for businesses, capital budgeting and things like that. And you don't talk about libertarianism per se, but you just talk about how government intervenes and can upset business decision-making so businesses don't have the optimal result that they're looking for, but they have to deal with all the things that government throws at them, namely regulation, which can be a minefield for companies if they don't follow the regs properly. They can be fined. People can even go to jail. If they don't file a tax return accurately, they can be fined and go to jail. So there are a lot of minefields out there that the government puts in the place of entrepreneurs who are the backbone of the economy. If you don't have entrepreneurship, if you don't have capital investment, you don't have a modern industrialized economy. And that's something, unfortunately, the decision makers in Washington on both sides of the aisle need to embrace wholeheartedly and just allow people to be free. That's what America is all about. That's why my parents came to with me and my older brother to America in 1949 to live in a free society after they were the only ones in their respective families to survive the Holocaust.
Mm. Well, there you go. I mean, a very concise and readily understandable way of explaining this. I really appreciate that because, you know, there have been many a person that I've discussed libertarianism with on this show, and frankly, most of them cannot articulate these things so well. So I'm going to ask you some loaded questions here, you know, as objectively as I can, because these are the things that, quite frankly, even political candidates, individuals who are businessmen, don't seem to be able to answer when I ask them. And if they do, they get rather upset about it. And I think that you'll be able to handle it in an academic sort of way. And none of this has been prepared, folks, by the way. Nothing was discussed ahead of time. So this is completely unscripted, what you're about to hear. And so I'm going to ask you a few, I think, are fairly challenging questions that I never get the answer to from someone who claims to be a libertarian. And I'm not saying that you're just someone who claims it. I'm saying you're somebody who lives it. But let's get there. Here's the thing. When I look at certain things in history, let's begin with the 1949 era, okay? And the building of what a lot of people call the middle class in America. And of course, there is a great deal of nostalgia for that time period. We'd like to return to it, etc. You know, look, a whole bunch of political campaigns have been based on let's go back to that time. Why? Well, it's interesting to me that in the post-war economic landscape, that there was some government intervention, that there was a bit of a fluffing up of the economy, it seems like, and it seemed to go in a positive direction. Now, I'm born in the 70s, and any government intervention that I've ever witnessed for myself in my lifetime has resulted in, you know, some scale, somewhere on the scale of disaster, okay, one way or another. You know, as soon as I started to experience participation in money and life, what was I confronted with immediately? Stagflation, right? Born mm-hmm. in 72. So as soon as I'm learning about money and how money works and things like that, I'm dealing with that, you know, ecosphere, if you will, of the economic experience here in America. As far as I'm concerned, there has never been a time where government intervention has worked, you know, and again, Nixon was president when I was born, you know, and the first guy I remember being president, honestly, is Ford. frankly. But anyway, here we are. What about that, though? Because some people argue that some level of government intervention, even you talked about regulations. Some people would argue that without some regulations, people would act completely irresponsibly. And I got to tell you, I sort of side with them in some cases, that many reckless things would be done without some level of restriction and regulation. Are you entirely for the removal of absolutely? Like, is it an absolutist thing with you? Or should it be an absolutist thing with someone who is embracing the libertarian philosophy? Should there be no government intervention or regulation whatsoever is the major question, I guess.
Yeah, if you look at the history of regulation, it's always been done at the behest of some powerful business or group of people who want to get special privileges from the government at the expense of the general public. That has been documented from the beginning of the Republic, whether it was the banking sector, whether it was transportation, whether it was tariffs to keep out cheaper goods from overseas. Again, and this was done by a left-wing economist called The Triumph of Conservatism by Gabriel Coco. He was a historian, and he went through the Progressive period, which was supposed to be an anti-business period where there was an uprising of the general public against big business, and he uncovered that the essence of the progressivism was big business was getting together to shaft the public by getting regulations that sounded like anti-business, but it was really the crony capitalism that emerged from the progressive period. And this has gone on in every sector of the economy. And then for his credit, Jimmy Carter got rid of the airline cartels, the trucking cartels in the 70s, and that freed up the economy in the 1980s, and prices were coming down to the great benefit of companies and individuals. So again, if you look at the history of regulation, it really is an anti-public movement as opposed to an anti-business movement. And this is the revisionist view of regulation in the country. And by the way, we do have regulation in the free market. It's called contracts, that if someone breaches a contract, you can sue them in court for damages. And remember, in our system, you're innocent until you're proven guilty. So you have to go to court to show that you were aggressed against by whoever you're having the contract with, that they didn't fulfill the contract, and you should be awarded damages for someone's egregious behavior. So again, the question of regulation and no regulation is there is regulation. It's called the free market and contracts. If people adhere to contracts, then everything is fine. When I've bought houses over the years, you have a contract. Each party has an attorney, and you spell out the terms and conditions of selling the property, and everyone is satisfied. And if there's a breach of contract for whatever reason, you try to collect damages, or you go to court, whatever the case may be. So there's no conflict between good regulation, which is the free market, and bad regulation, which is the government. We don't need the bad regulation because, as history has shown, the government regulation is not done for the general public, but it's done for special interests. And there's a term for this. It's called regulatory capture, whether it's in the pharmaceutical industry, whether it's in the oil industry, whether it's in the, quote, green industry. Companies are getting subsidies because some group of Congress people are putting together a bill. They sneak into an omnibus bill, and this is what happened with Biden's $1.7 trillion omnibus bill. There's a lot of pork in there because people, the lobbyists, grease the skids for their clients, and that's what they're paid to do.
So what you would say is that, okay, what about the idea of regulations, though, that are meant to protect the general public? Now, I realize that the majority of what we see nowadays that is written, it is always created to benefit the larger, it actually defeats competition is what it does, because it makes it so that the only people that are able to function, or the only entities, excuse me, not people, I get confused, because corporations are supposed to be people now. and all that, but excuse me on that. But, I mean, the only corporations that seemingly get allowed to function are those that are in a privileged position, which is anti-competition at this time. But what about the general sort of ideas like, well, you know, we talked about Nixon there briefly. What about his creation of the EPA and the idea that collectively some sort of watchdog organization is required sometimes, I mean, because otherwise some people would be very reckless about the way they treat the environment. And then you have individuals having, you know, like, here we go. Let's take it to a New Jersey level again. You know, the issue with, like, say, a Seba Geigy, right? In because I lived in Toms River. I'm sure you're familiar with this and the chemical poisoning that they did of the water table. Now, theoretically, it would have been nice if government regulation had been in place to watch over that and not allow it to have happened in the first place. And theoretically, according to many people, it was. But we know what the result is, okay? And we know that there was a lot of damage done there. So what about those sorts of regulations that are meant to protect the general public from things like that? I mean, do you entirely object to that, or you figure that can also be handled through contract disputes?
Absolutely. More importantly, it should be handled through property rights. If the water table is who owns the water table? If and that's one of the problems of environmental regulation. There was a great article, God, in the late 60s called The Tragedy of the Commons. And the point of that article was that once you, when you don't have ownership and you have sort of public ownership, if you will, where the government controls property or whatever, you get overgrazing of the land. And when you have property rights, the people who own the property have an incentive, because when you own something, you eventually want to sell it, and in order to sell it at a good price, you have to maintain that property. Just as homeowners maintain their property, the roof, the sidewalks, the plumbing, the electricity, because eventually they're going to sell it. And so when we owned homes, we made sure that home was in good condition, because one day we knew we were going to sell it. So when it comes to pollution, it's basically an issue of trespass, because Seba Geigy trespassed on someone's water table, and therefore they're liable because they committed a tort, and they should have been sued up the gazoo to make the people whose water table was damaged and get the damages for that pollution that they caused at the water table. So again, the free market has the mechanism in place. It's called the legal system to make sure that companies don't do these egregious activities. And Mr. Libertarian Murray Rothbard 40 years ago wrote a great piece for the Cato Journal on air pollution and other forms of pollution from a property rights libertarian perspective, and it's considered a classic of libertarianism and environmental, for lack of a better term, degradation of how the free market would prevent environmental degradation to the best, better than government regulation.
Mm. See, the only problem here, in my mind, and look, I'm not trying to be contrarian with you. It's just that these are the challenges I see.
Sure.
You know, so let's understand each other here about this. The legal system is not the most accessible thing to someone like myself, some other people in general. We don't always know how it works. We are not easily engaged with it. And quite honestly, you know, these larger corporations, as per usual, are able to hire better lawyers and almost, you know, seemingly like they own the legal system too. You know, try to sue a large corporation, even based on the idea that they've trespassed, they've done damage to your property. It's very, very difficult to achieve any sort of result because, first of all, the laws and all of these other, you know, ins and outs are so complex at this point that, indeed, a common citizen has a hell of a time taking it in and understanding what's happening in the first place. But, I mean, if it was brought back to a more basic sort of idea, like you said, look, it's about trespass, it's about damage, you know, that should be assessed. But by the time it's so convoluted in our current legal situation, you know, I would love to hold up hope suing a large company that did something to my property or to me. But time and time again, I mean, we see that for the most part, either a small payment is made, I mean, whether it's a drug manufacturer or it's a chemical manufacturer or a car manufacturer, it doesn't matter. The bigger of the entity always seems to win. And, well, what about that? I mean, because, look, if you seek answers and, you know, restitution from the legal system, you know, I mean, I throw up my hands. I try to avoid going into a court ever.
Sure.
You know, personally. Well, so go ahead.
There are two things. One is if you see immediate threat or harm to your property, you go to court and get an injunction. And there are enough public interest law firms, there are enough lawyers who would do pro bono work because some corporations don't have a very good reputation, and there are always people out trying to get these corporations to behave in a much better fashion. The other thing is you go through the newspapers. Newspapers love these type of stories. This is the muckraking that was going on in American journalism for decades, and they love to write a story about a company dumping toxic waste in a canal, like we had up in Love Canal in New York State, or other things, whether it's Ciba Geigy in New Jersey, or companies with coal mines and whatever they're doing with the waste from coal mines. So there are enough people out there of goodwill who will be willing to pick up a story, especially when it's a compelling story, because the court of public opinion is very powerful. The last thing corporations want to see is bad publicity, because that is really bad for business. And Warren Buffett has a great quote, don't do anything that you don't want to see in the front page of the local newspaper. And that, to me, is what everyone should live by, because if you don't do anything, if you do something that ends up in the front page of the paper, that it's an egregious act of pollution or anything else, your reputation is hurt. You may lose business. You may lose work. And so transparency is the best disinfectant for bad behavior.
See, it is, but given the current media landscape, I mean, you'll find that it's rather difficult to spread the word, because the local newspaper is almost an extinct species at this point in a lot of parts of the country. So you don't have the local interest like you used to, where you could maybe go and see a reporter in your very town that wrote about things that were happening in that town. It's very much been centralized, and it's become a lot more difficult as well. Look, again, I'm not trying to just be a contrarian here with you. I'm just putting forth that we have a situation that has incrementally, certainly over the course of my lifetime, I'm a little younger than you, done nothing but deteriorate. You know, the fourth of state, so to speak, has become extremely weak and co-opted, and they are generally sponsored by the large corporations. I mean, I'll tell you that, you know, try and get some word out that a drug company is harming people. Where are you going to go? Every network is sponsored by the largest drug companies possible. So they have a business arrangement that already precludes them from criticizing their sponsors. So there goes ABC, NBC, CBS, CNN, Fox News, depending on which corporation you're suing. You know, all of those big major distribution points are gone. You don't have access to them. And on the local level, you have another problem, like I said, and it's over time. And I would say that the free market has clearly dictated that they're not as necessary because of social media and things like that. What about those institutions that used to be of local interest and all that when it comes to the press? I mean, because the free market, as far as I can see, has determined that they're no longer useful. I argue that they should be useful. They should be retained and kept in business, and I really wish they were, but unfortunately that's not the current landscape, right? I mean, a newspaper, sorry to say, Murray, but a newspaper is almost like, what are you talking about? Oh, one of those things that we used to have made out of paper? You know, it's almost non-existent now. I know there's ways around that and everything else, but you know, what do you think about that regarding this? Because you don't have the ability to really nail one of these large, you know, try to go against an oil company or again, a drug company. If you can find somebody that's not sponsored by Pfizer and you want to tell them a story about Pfizer, I want to know where you went because I don't know where they are. So
I'm glad you brought up Pfizer, because Pfizer has been getting a free ride given all the criticism about the so-called vaccine from around the world by prominent physicians and epidemiologists and other experts in the field. They've been shut out by the mainstream media, and the only place you can find criticism of the vaccine and the harm that it's done is on websites that have an open platform where people can criticize, whether it's Substack or Rumble or places like that, because it's Facebook and Twitter before Musk bought it out, and they would censor reports on contrary opinion regarding the Pfizer and Moderna drugs. Mm-hmm. So again, the mainstream media, which I grew up with in the 1950s and 60s, they've done a terrible job during COVID in not allowing the full expression of opinion on a very important topic, namely COVID, and what are the alternatives to the shots, and what are the protocols that would be better suited for individuals, whether it's hydroxychloroquine or ivermectin or other protocols that doctors around the world have been using with no side effects. So again, we don't live in a perfect world. Human beings are imperfect, so our institutions are going to be imperfect. Mm-hmm. And so we can't expect the government to make that better, because government is the most destructive institution in the history of the world, given how many people have been killed by governments in the last 200 years. It numbers into the several hundred million. So why do we trust people who are in government? They don't have our best interests at heart, because if they did, there wouldn't be any wars. There wouldn't be any onerous taxation or regulations. But they are in bed with the special interests. And as I pointed out, this has been going on since the beginning of the Republic. So this, what we're seeing today, is nothing new. And that's why you need a vigorous press in our country. But the press has been in bed with big tech and the government for the last 10, 20 years. And that's why people are frustrated. And thank goodness for the Internet, where you can find alternative views on a whole host of subjects, especially war and peace and whatever corporations are doing to undermine the free market with getting in bed with the politicians. And so I love to read articles about uncovering bad behavior by corporations and how the politicians are there for life, for the most part, raking in campaign contributions and having enormous power over the economy. And that's not what they were sent to Washington for, is to rule over the American people. They were there to serve the American people. And from my perspective, as a libertarian, the best way to serve the people is don't do any harm. Just as doctors are not supposed to do any harm with the Hippocratic Oath, we should have a Jeffersonian oath. Don't do any harm with your rules and regulations and your laws. And that's not what's happened in America. Well, the law has been used as a weapon against peaceful activity. And that's the thing that upsets me, because I know where this could lead if it doesn't stop, because we've seen authoritarian societies come about initially from very small regulations and rules and mandates, and then it just grows like a mushroom in the forest, and then one day we wake up and all our liberties that are guaranteed to the people under the Constitution are gone.
Mm. Yeah, well, look, this network and my show both also removed from YouTube because of criticizing the air quotes now people vaccine. So you know, that's why we got taken down, and that's what they will do, because again, the larger platforms, just like you know, your Facebooks and everything else, this is what they've done. And you mentioned a few alternative sites, but constantly there is a struggle with this, because trying to get out information, or even making statements like I did, apparently this is a no-no. You know, I can do it, though, because my website is my broadcast. I own it. So there you go. But, you know, the deal is, I said things like, look, the same people that are bringing you the opioid crisis, okay, that you're complaining about, are the same people that you're trusting, yes, I'm going to, without the information, take an injection. This is exactly who you're trusting. Johnson & Johnson in particular, everybody forgets, they were in the mix here. They were one of the three authorized, right, mm-hmm. under emergency authorization. But Pfizer, I mean, I can sit here probably for the next 2 hours and read you a list of things that Pfizer has put on the market that did damage to people. And, you know, I would just say at the very least, you're not dealing with a trustworthy entity that is also looking to do no harm. And I think that not enough people are knowledgeable about that. And yet they're the leader here in this country for this thing that you're supposed to accept sight unseen and allow it into your body, into the bodies of your family, because it's allegedly your public, you know, duty to do this. You know, you're going to kill grandma, you're going to kill your neighbors if you don't take this shot. And I wasn't even being extreme about it. In my mind, I mean, other people have called it a Holocaust. I have not said that myself. I don't disagree with people who say it. But I'll tell you, I haven't said it myself. I just say, question it. And they kick me out. They shut me down. You know, so my point is that it is very difficult. You have to search for information. I'm sorry, I got on my soapbox for a minute instead of asking you questions. But I think it's a worthy thing to bring up here because it is not working. The free market right now, and I want to know if you disagree with me. The concept, people go, well, look, this is a free market. Not right now, it isn't. I don't believe so in the smallest way, I don't believe so. I think you used the proper term already, which is crony capitalism. Not really, truthfully, capitalism in progress here. This is not the situation that we're in. Or do you disagree with me?
Well, we know that it's not the free market because what industry has immunity from liability because their product may harm people? And that's what the drug companies get, and that's what Pfizer and Moderna and Johnson got with the so-called vaccine. Right. So, again, here's another example of crony capitalism, special privileges of anti-free market approaches to pharmaceuticals. And I do my due diligence when this vaccine came out or they were planning it, and I spoke to a lot of people. I attended webinars, and from what I was able to glean from all the reading I did and the people I spoke to in the medical profession, there was no need to take this so-called vaccine because vaccines take years and years to develop. And besides, why do you need a booster a few months after you take a vaccine? Mm-hmm. I got the polio vaccine in the 1950s. Never had a booster since then. So that's nearly 70 years ago. And the whole concept of government involvement in medicine is the last thing you want in a free society because they can, as we saw, there were mandates to taking this, or you lose your job, or you can't serve in the military. And this, to me, is anathema in a free society, that this was an illness that basically attacked elderly with comorbidities. Young people should not take the vaccine. They have pretty good immune systems. And so the whole thing has been a total disaster because when the swine flu came out and they had the vaccine for it and people were dying immediately, they took it off the market. And now there are estimates of tens of thousands of people may have been seriously injured and died from this vaccine. So I think we're seeing how government and the pharma are so closely intertwined, and the media are not allowing any dissent from the narrative, the party line, if you will, from the government and big pharma, because they tell us that it's safe and effective. Well, if it's safe and effective, my argument would be, if I get an illness, would you compensate me for my illness, or will you put money in my estate if I die from the vaccine? And if it's effective, why are people getting COVID after they get the vaccine and boosters? So basically what they're telling us is not correlating with reality, because people have died who've had the vaccine, and people are still getting COVID with the vaccine. And now we're seeing hospitalizations occurring from the vaccinated, not the unvaccinated.
Right.
And when Joe Biden said this is a pandemic of the unvaccinated, that to me is just so stupid that I'm just wondering who's feeding him these lines, or is he ad-libbing this? Because that's probably one of the dumbest statements I've heard from an American president in my lifetime, and yet the media are not calling him out on it, And it's frustrating for those of us who have been around a long time and have seen politicians lie to us consistently since Eisenhower said the YouTube plane that was shot down by the Russians, the Soviets, was not a spy plane back in the 1950s. Right. And so they lied us into war, whether it's Vietnam or the Gulf War. They keep on lying to us over and over again. And why people have trust in politicians who the old joke is, how do you know if a politician is lying? See if his lips are moving. It applies to people who are in power.
No, absolutely. And look, I feel like the only, and I don't think the libertarian candidates that are out there right now are the end all and be all of the solution, but I think they are the beginning of a possible solution, you know, when it comes to this very corrupt and very deranged system that is in place. I mean, we're not going to be able to snap our fingers and solve this overnight, I don't think. But the circumstance is that we have, you know, public servants who don't serve the public, who do serve themselves quite well. I mean, look at the amount of millionaires that are made out of making a couple hundred thousand dollars a year in Congress, right? Suddenly mm-hmm. they have fortunes when they leave. And the thing is, I am suspect of a lot of this stuff and always suspect of anybody who runs for office anyway. But I hope you guys out there can see why it is I might have voted for this guy, because this, you're not sending out a different message. You have not changed. I do believe, though, that libertarianism has been kind of hijacked a bit. And I wonder what your thoughts are on that, because to me, a lot of people that call themselves libertarians at this point in time are really just on the right-wing side of the equation. And that's it. They haven't really embraced this idea or gone to the point of thinking that, you know, the people would make the best decisions and so on and so forth for themselves. They're really on the right-wing side of the equation, but they didn't used to get invited into the right-wing tent, if you know what I mean, at the circus, all right? Mm-hmm. So now they've embraced libertarianism, in quotes, and they're not very libertarian in their behavior. They're not very libertarian in the things they propose, the things they continuously vote for. Okay? And I'll say this, I take swings at all sides here, all right? So what's bad is bad, that's it. I don't care what letter you got in front of your name or behind it, in fact. But, you know, with this vaccine, I don't want to hover on it too long. But, I mean, this is a prime example of what the problem is when the corporations are completely intertwined with the government. They are indiscernible from one another. And this is the kind of thing you get. By the way, I had Brent Hamacek on yesterday, who wrote a book about Dr. Zelenko. Have you ever read that book or heard about it?
No, I've seen Zelenko, and he passed away, unfortunately, recently
yes.
from cancer. And he was on top of things early on during COVID using his protocol, which saves lives.
Right. Right. Now, here's the thing. Nobody got to hear about that at the time, really, right? And I think a lot of lives could have been saved had that information been disseminated. But, of course, anything that would have spoken to, look, one of the primary things in his protocol was zinc, right? And it was one of the things that was advised to me personally when I got sick in 2020, right around the same time that he was treating people. You know, but it was not mentioned to me by Dr. Zelenko. It was mentioned to me by one of the very few people in the medical profession that I trust. And they gave me their idea of what the best way to combat it was, and it was survivable for me, etc. And I'm not even the healthiest guy in the world. But by observation, I could see what was happening. And yet, we have a media that was telling us, you know, don't believe your eyes. All you need to know is that this is safe and effective. This is safe and effective. And in fact, the whole, you know, idea that this is a pandemic of the unvaccinated. Well, I don't think that started with Joe Biden. In fact, you know, I do recall there was a president before that was very proud of his Operation Warp Speed and getting right involved with making sure that FedEx had all the funds it needed. Making sure that the Medicare fund was going to pay out for your free vaccines, you know, and literally, I mean, I found that there was a specific amount of money that was paid out for that. you know, per vaccine. So a blank check almost written to the three major drug companies that were involved. Also, plenty of money given to Federal Express, UPS, private shipping companies to make sure that they could get this refrigerated concoction out to people. And I saw the fully mechanized, I mean, people misquote all the time, Mussolini regarding this idea, because they're, it's a specious quote about the corporation and the government being in bed together. But the concept is sound. That's what I saw. And to me, that is more akin to fascism than it is to a free market. It is more akin to fascism than it is, God, I hate to even say it, a democracy, a representative republic. I don't care how you want to categorize it. That's not what we've seen over the past couple of years. By all means, take issue with anything I just said.
No, you're absolutely right, Chuck. We are living in a semi-fascist society. In fact, there was a book published nearly 50 years ago entitled America's Emerging Fascist Economy. And it was spot on, talking about all the regulatory agencies where business and government get in bed together. That's the essence of fascism. That's the definition of fascism, where there is a marriage, if you will, of business and government. And since businesses have the resources, they can basically help elect whoever they want to, whether it's senators, representatives, or even presidents. And so even though we have campaign finance laws, they have a network of people that they can tap to donate money, use super PACs that puts a lot of money into campaigns. And so when I look at the landscape today, I see basically a corrupt government that Democrats and Republicans both participate in. And let me give you the essence of my 97 campaign when I spoke to a group of students at Rutgers and talked about what libertarian ideas would do to the state of New Jersey. Spoke for about a half hour. It was a class taught by a Republican and Democrat consultants, a political science class. It was a class of about 80 students, as I recall. And I gave a half-hour presentation, and at the end of my talk, a student in the back raises his hand. He says, "Dr. Sabrin, you say you believe in limited government, personal responsibility, and free enterprise. What makes you different than a Republican?" I said, "I mean it." And that, I think, is what the students really appreciated, because they broke out in laughter, and that's what I put in the preface of my autobiography about the 97 campaign and the years that led up to it. Because I've heard Republicans sound like libertarians. In fact, when Nixon was running for president in 1968, people were whispering that he's really a libertarian, and that when Reagan ran in 1980, they say he's got a lot of libertarian ideas, and so on and so forth. But even Reagan couldn't reduce the size of government. He campaigned on getting rid of the Department of Education and Energy, and they're still around, and they're causing havoc in education and in the energy sector. And so you look at the federal government and you look at the Constitution and you see there's a big disconnect between what the Constitution authorizes specifically and what the government spends the money on. Unfortunately, the courts have used the general welfare clause of the Constitution to say the government can spend money on basically anything. I mean, if they wanted to subsidize diapers or subsidize, I don't know what, gym classes for people, they could do so because it's the general welfare. And that's that's the major flaw in the Constitution. It's not a straitjacket on government, but it's basically an open-ended invitation to spend money endlessly.
Mm. And there you have it. Look, I'm pretty sure that speech you gave at Rutgers was either covered in the Asbury Park Press or the Bergen Record, or possibly both, because I recall reading about it, but I guarantee you they didn't give you that many details. They gave you short shrift in the article. maybe you remember a little more, but that's what it seemed like to me. Nonetheless, the ideas definitely resonated with me, and I saw what was being shown to me as the Libertarian Party at that time as something that was, well, effectively most akin to the non-aggression philosophy.
Right.
You know, and I saw it that way. And a major thing was the drug war to me. This is one of the grandest deceptions that has been loosed upon us, you know, along with all the things we've already discussed, is this idea that, you know, there's a war on drugs. which, as you know, George Carlin would observe, look, we're a very warlike people. We declare war on everything, mm-hmm. right? How do you have a war on drugs? Well, you don't have a war on drugs, but they do have a war on people, and they justify it with drugs. You know, and I saw the libertarians at that time as being for the absolute removal of any prohibition regarding things like this, as they would have been against the prohibition against alcohol. This is not the government's business to deal with this on a personal level. What are your thoughts on that and the drug war in general and the libertarian stance there?
Let me take you back to the late 50s when The Untouchables, the TV series, came on the air with Robert Stack playing Elliot Ness. Sure. And here I am, how old am I, 12, 13, 14 years old, watching The Untouchables. And here they are going after bootleggers. And I'm saying to myself, liquor is legal today. Why was it illegal back then? And you had judges being bribed, politicians being killed, politicians being on the payroll, judges being on the payroll, police being killed, police being bribed. And so prohibition was the greatest social disaster in American history, and now we have it again with the war on drugs. I mean, drugs don't do anything except if you take them when you're not supposed to take them. They'll be great harm to you, just as gun control. It's not about gun control. It's about people control. People have a right to self-defense. The whole concept of the government being your overseer, your nanny, is repugnant to me, because you have to be an educated person and know what's good for you and what's not good for you. And so on a personal level, I took a puff of a cigarette at age 15, and I said, this is not for me, and I never smoked. I hardly drink because of a variety of reasons. And so the only time I really have any wine is the Passover when we have a Seder, and I grew up with that. So I'm very comfortable drinking wine at the Seder, Passover Seder. But the whole concept of that the government can tell you what to ingest in your body doesn't make any sense, because if that was the case, then you'd ban alcohol, you'd ban tobacco, you'd ban a whole bunch of food items which cause obesity and diabetes and cancer and a whole host of things. Mm-hmm. So this is about cultural issues, where the government thinks that it's being altruistic by preventing drugs from coming in. And by the way, the greatest proponents of prohibition are the drug dealers, because they're making billions of dollars on prohibition. And the sad reality is now we have this fentanyl crisis, and from what I've been reading about, there could be some intervention there, because what the drug dealers are doing is they're selling black market Xanax and other prescription drugs laced with fentanyl. So they're committing huge fraud in the marketplace, the black market, because people are getting these drugs that they should be getting a prescription for in the black market, and drug dealers, for some reason, are lacing them with fentanyl. So I don't understand that. And why anyone would take drugs without doctor supervision is beyond me. I mean, I don't take any drugs without supervision, because I want to know what the side effects are. I want to know what the protocol is to if I have an illness and how long I should take the drug, and so on and so forth. Now, a responsible physician will tell you all that. And unfortunately, we have a drug culture, because anxiety levels are through the roof because of COVID and other pressures that are on young people. And it's a sad commentary on how American society has evolved the last 10, 20, 30 years.
Mm. No, absolutely. And look, I smoke. I've been addicted to tobacco almost my whole life, right? I mean, almost about 40 years now I've been smoking. But you know what? I recognize that it's probably not the best thing for me to do. But here's the thing. I don't think it's the government's business. I don't think it's your business. I mean, I told you, but I don't think it's your business. It's my issue. It's my problem.
Sure.
You know, and I've never understood this desire to, and I'll tell you, I extend that to all these substances. Again, that's your personal philosophy. That's fine. That works for me. There are plenty of people that won't touch this or that or the third thing. They've literally, through prohibition, given the rise to all sorts of dangerous things because of prohibition. And I got to tell you, I resent this opioid crisis situation on the highest level, because I've been exposed to drugs my whole life. And frankly, again, look, I could give you a history on it, but I'm not going to. I'm just going to say to you that I am well aware of what it is like on a street level to deal with this. Okay. I am well aware of what it's like there. And I got to tell you that if it were not for those laws, there would be a lot less deaths. There would be a lot more, sensible individuals who, regardless of what it is they choose to ingest, okay, nobody would get killed for it if it wasn't for prohibition, okay? It's just that simple. And they've given rise to this situation. Now, fentanyl, by the way, was available as early as 1980. I can tell you that firsthand. It's not new. The opioid crisis, I laugh because we have been through various phases of different opioid crises in this country. And I definitely experienced one, but I got to tell you, I think hardly anyone cared because it stayed in a certain segment of society for a long time. Heroin was a big problem when I was growing up. There were plenty of people dying from it. There was plenty of it cheaply available on the street. And so, you know, that's an opioid, too. It was readily available, and frankly, a lot of people that go for the black market pills or the illegally obtained pills or whatever now, you know what? A lot of times they'll wind up resorting to the heroin as just a matter of fact because it's cheaper and easier to obtain. I mean, that is the weird part about all this. It is totally turned on its head, and I think that it didn't even become part of public discourse until it became absolutely ubiquitous, where there was no escaping it. Every segment of society got touched by it. I mean, impolitely, I call it the rise of hillbilly heroin, because that's what they called OxyContin on the street for a while, okay? Mm-hmm. And that's what it was. And if it wasn't for that, and if it wasn't so portable and wasn't so easy to move around and you didn't have a black market for it, you would not have this circumstance where it might be a good idea for many people in your neighborhood to have Narcan around. Okay, and I mean every neighborhood at this point, because this stuff is everywhere and all forms. And I think it got that way by design. But here I go with my conspiratorial sort of mindset, where I think this was intentionally done. And I think most things that we see have actually been intentionally done. Now, I don't ask you to comment on that, but I will say that I'd love for you know, more libertarians to address this, which is that I think the prohibition in and of itself has caused the black market to thrive and has caused a much higher death rate than we would ever see if this was all decriminalized tomorrow. I really feel that way. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, there was, as you know, Portugal decriminalized everything, and drug addiction is treated as a health issue, which it is. And so it's just amazing to me that alcohol is not treated alcoholism is not treated as a criminal issue. It's treated as a disease. It's classified as a disease. So again, this is part of the cultural antagonism we have in this country that really dates back to the 19th century when the Progressive Period got started, because one of the things that they wanted to do was to ban alcohol, because they thought it was sinful to drink excessively because it clouded your mind and you couldn't be a productive individual. So if you want to see the roots of prohibition, you really have to go back to the Progressive Period, where they had this view of the world that the government was supposed to instill virtue in the citizenry. That is the essence of prohibition, that the citizenry is weak and that the government's going to come in and make sure that people behave properly. And that's why a lot of Republicans support these rules and mandates and prohibitions, and the Democrats used to be more libertarianish on these issues, but they also have fallen into line with using the government for that. But I think that some Democrats want to decriminalize drugs, because I think some of them see the futile nature of prohibition, which is a good first step, but they haven't gone all the way. And I think Republicans are falling into the trap of that government is supposed to be the virtue enforcer in society, And to me, that's self-defeating, because virtue has to come from your inner self, not from external forces.
Exactly. And I'm going to take a break here real fast and continue to talk to Murray Sabrin on the other side. I'll see how long I can keep him for, but this is a very solid conversation that I'm appreciating quite a bit, and I hope you guys are too. By the way, Murray, you know, I don't remember seeing a virtue police clause in the Constitution. Did I miss it somewhere?
Well, that's it. I mean, they make things up. And this is why ideas, the history of ideas, is so important to understand where, how we evolve as a society.
Exactly. Anyway, stick around. The Ocelli Effect will return after this.
Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now.
For as little as $50 a month, you can buy an ad for your business, podcast, book, or any message you want heard on one or more of the Ocelli.com shows. To find out more, contact ads@Ocelli.com. That's ads@Ocelli.com. Be heard with us. Revelation through conversation. Ocelli.com.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times, and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
Go ahead, caller.
Yeah, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, he knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination looked into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
Ocelli.com.
Revelation through conversation.
Mad Prophet of the Airways.
I am here every Thursday, 3 o'clock to 5 o'clock Pacific time, right here on the Ocelli Radio Network, which is really one of the most, I think it's the gem in the landscape of media today. Please donate, buy a coffee and some smokes for my man, my producer, and the owner of this network, Chuck, today by donating at Ocelli.com. Keep it alive. Keep it alive.
Ocelli.com.
Revelation through
conversation.
So the second and final segment of tonight's Ocelli Effect with Murray Sabrin, again, you know, an interesting guy that I heard on the Jack Blood Show for sure. And then I remembered, wow, wait a second. I voted for this guy like many years ago. And Murray reminded me that it was 1997. And that makes perfect sense. And yes, I do remember not wanting to vote for Christy Todd Whitman. I don't remember McGreevy being on the other side there. See, now, to me, he was the guy who got removed from the governor position a few years later when he ascended to the governor's mansion when Christy Todd Whitman left to go lead the EPA. And then he was removed under a scandal, which, well, anyway, you can look that up for yourself, Jim McGreevy. But I really would have liked it much better had Murray Sabrin become the governor of New Jersey. And I think New Jersey would have been irrevocably altered if he had. Anyways, so before we get going, though, I do want to let people know where they can go and take a look at things that you've written and things you've had to say publicly. You know, not everybody would have ever gotten to go to Ramapo, and besides, you've retired now. Although, I don't know, maybe you go there sometimes and, you know, you're one of those professors who comes in and out, maybe? what do they
well,
call
well,
it?
Well, we're now in Southwest Florida, Chuck, so it's a long way to New Jersey from Southwest Florida, but I hope to get up north sometime this year.
Maybe I'll try and catch a ride with you if you drive, because I'd love to go back to Jersey for a visit. I'm kidding. But the point is that I do miss New Jersey. Anyway, thing about this, though, is I do want to let people know where to go see your stuff, but before we get there, I like that you mentioned that people have tried to sort of adapt libertarianism into, and that's a loose word right now for me, into what they're presenting publicly. But as you said, you hear tones of it, and then their actions are just so completely, diametrically opposed to what libertarianism is. And so I'm really glad to have had you on and really discuss these things at length, and I appreciate your patience with me tonight. So is there anything else that we should include here as this is almost like a primer to libertarianism in its reality, in its best form, in my mind? And I'm really glad you did this. Thank you. So, yeah, go ahead. If there's anything else that we should add, and then also tell people where they can go to see things that you have presented or do write or do present.
Sure. Thanks, Chuck. Basically, I'm going to spend the next few months promoting my work, my books, my ideas, my Substack column to educate the American people. That I've been an educator for 35 years, and I think I've done a pretty good job helping young people develop the skills they need in the business world. And now I want to educate the American people as much as possible on the ideas that will make America a better place. And so I call this the Restore the Constitution or the Restore the Republic tour. And by being on podcasts like yours and others, and hopefully break into some of the big-time cable and TV shows, to point out to people that what we have today is an aberration. It's not what the founders envisioned for America, where we have this all-encompassing federal government, endless wars overseas, endless money printing to try to stimulate the economy, which doesn't work, and rules and regulations that are not consistent with the Bill of Rights. So this is my current career. After retiring from teaching, I'm not retired. I've been around a long time, and I feel that I have a responsibility as a naturalized citizen, and it took an oath to uphold the Constitution, to bring that message to the American people that our liberties are threatened by people in Washington who think they know better than we do of how to run our lives. And I find that very offensive, quite frankly, that being a sovereign individual is the essence of being an American. In fact, in the 1960s, when I was an undergraduate, one Sunday I was watching a show on Passover. It was a religious program on ABC News, Channel 7, WABC, and they interviewed a rabbi, and he said the essence of Judaism is the sanctity of the individual. And that stuck with me almost 60 years, 50, 55 years, that individualism does not mean that you're isolated in a community. It means that you're part of a community, but no one has the right to aggress against you, which is the essence of libertarianism. In fact, after the 97 campaign, Chuck, you'll get a kick out of this, I received a letter from a rabbi in central New Jersey asking me to speak to his congregation on a Friday night, and my topic was why Jews should be libertarians. If there's any group of people who should be libertarian, who should be opposed to big government, it's the Jewish people, because they've been oppressed throughout our history. And so I made I connected the dots between the Ten Commandments, thou shalt not kill, thou shalt not steal, the fundamental principles of libertarianism, the non-aggression principle. And so that's easy to understand. And so if you don't steal and don't kill, then everything falls into place, and we would have a harmonious society with a continuous prosperity. And so my job is very simple, is to get the word out, being interviewed by podcasters like yourself and others, and just make the case that we can do a lot better than what has been going on in Washington for 100 years.
No, absolutely. So what is the do you have a central website? Or, I mean, look, you can email me the stuff afterwards, and I'll put it in the show notes, anything that you want to point people to directly.
Sure. My books are available on Amazon. My latest book is my memoir, From Immigrant to Public Intellectual, An American Story. It just came out a couple of months ago, and I'm very proud of it. The publisher loves it. Michael Harrison, the publisher of Talkers Magazine, the Bible of Talk Radio, wrote the foreword. His publishing arm, Talkers Books, published it. And now I'm on a publicity tour on radio and TV to get the message out, and hopefully sell a few books with it. And I have books on healthcare. I have books on the boom bust cycle, the Federal Reserve, and my first book on how to have a tax-free America, which is consistent with libertarian philosophy. So it's all available on Amazon. So go to Amazon, and the publisher deliberately priced the book so inexpensively, the Kindle and the paperback, because he wants people to buy multiple copies and give them out to friends and relatives, and learn about my personal story and how that's interwoven with the events of the past 60 years, and how I became a libertarian in the early 70s and eventually became the New Jersey gubernatorial candidate in 1997, and where I was the first third-party candidate to debate the major party candidates. So it's been a wonderful journey, and I and my journey is not ending. I just wanted to continue doing what I do best, I think, is explaining ideas that people have, I think, misconceptions about. And if they go to my Substack column, I write there twice a week. MurraySabrin.substack.com.
Right. Sorry, MurraySabrin.substack.com. Absolutely. And I'll give links to your author's page as well as your books on Amazon. Definitely want to make sure that people take a look at them. They are priced cheap, actually. And I just for the record, I do read Talkers Magazine as well. That's one of those things I get all the time. So I'm aware of Michael Harrison. I didn't know he published your book, though. That's great. And, I really want to make sure that we can have another discussion, actually, be a little more specific about your personal story next time. What do you think? You willing to come back?
Oh, absolutely, Chuck. I mean, this is my career now. My career now is to educate as many Americans as possible. And since it's a large country and so many podcasters and TV and cable shows out there, hopefully I can do this for a long, long time, because being in the classroom was my high, if you will. It was great being in the classroom, interacting with young people and teaching them basic skills and teaching them about the financial history of the United States, which they absolutely loved the course, because it was a fun course in learning about how American society evolved from the lens of finance and economics.
Absolutely. Murray Sabrin again, and I'll give you guys all the links in the show notes. Stick around. I'll be right back, actually, with Mike Swanson on the Ocelli Effect. Stick around.
WallStreetWindow.com. Gold, silver, the stock market. WallStreetWindow.com.
Perhaps you're invested deeply.
Perhaps you're not in deep enough. Maybe you're thinking about getting started. WallStreetWindow.com. Michael Swanson, the brilliant author of The War State, understood these trends professionally for many years, and now he gives you the benefit of his knowledge. WallStreetWindow.com. Go there now. Go there now. Go there now.
The War State by Michael Swanson explains the great national transformation that took place and put the Kennedy presidency in the context of the times and reveals never-before-published information about the Cuban Missile Crisis. President Kennedy would not have been assassinated if he had been president 200 years ago. His assassination took place in the context of the Cold War and the rise of the national security state. Before World War II, the United States was a continental republic. In the decade that followed, it became an imperial superpower. Generals such as Curtis LeMay not only wanted to invade Cuba, but knew that there were short-range missiles on the island armed with nuclear warheads that they could not destroy because they were on mobile launchers. Their invasion could have led to a third world war, and they wanted to go to war anyway. The War State by Michael Swanson reveals why and will show you what President Kennedy was up against. For more information, thewarstate.com.
Support Chuck O'Chilly at chili.com.
There's no money in it, so
yeah, that is
that's the problem.
That's the biggest problem, I think. And you know, some people would say that, look, you're in an age when you can be independently supported, but quite frankly, I'm on that business model too. And look, I'm not going to complain, but I'm going to complain, okay? Because people want to support you, they love you to death, but honestly,
so if you're listening in, this is a very unsubtle request to support the damn show, and I want you to do this too, because you know, the Ocelli Report is one of the few places where Greg Palast can get his stuff out. I mean, you'll still see my bylines in some of these outlets, but nevertheless, you know, I used to be a regular on CNN and on MSDNC, but no more.
Revelation through conversation.
Ocelli.com.
Go ahead, caller.
Hey, I'm interested in the truth about the JFK assassination.
Right. Well, what do you want to know?
Judy Baker's wild claim, Oswald girlfriend, she knew Ruby and Barry, cancer weapons. Really?
I imagine I could claim I have four wheels. It doesn't make me a wagon, but okay.
Oswald was on the kill team and trying to prevent the murder of John Kennedy. Come on now. Has a real expert on the JFK assassination look into her claims?
Go to Amazon.com. Enter Judith Baker in her own words. You'll get results for a digital copy of a book where Walt Brown utilizes her own words and the known evidence in the case to get at, well, a different perspective, let's say. You can get Judith Barry Baker in her own words from the author himself, signed if you request it, by contacting Dr. Brown at KIASJFK@AOL.com. It's a fun book, and it actually dissects the many, many fantastic claims. Judith Barry Baker in her own words.
Thank you for all the great information.
In denial. Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks by Larry Hancock. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. Larry Hancock's book, In Denial, rips the cover off many of them. Using new files, it exposes things about the Bay of Pigs that no one has ever written about before. It shows why it really failed and why the United States did not learn from it. Secret Wars became a staple of U.S. covert operations and are still happening today. It also shows why other countries today are doing secret operations with more success. This is the book that puts what some want to deny into the light. In Denial, Secret Wars with Airstrikes and Tanks. Larry Hancock. For more information, go to larry-hancock.com. Pick up your copy of In Denial at amazon.com in digital or physical form.
Do you like history, real history, that you were never taught in schools? Why? The Vietnam War, Nuclear Bombs and Nation Building in Southeast Asia by author Mike Swanson, with new documentation never seen before that'll open your eyes to events that led up to this. Why? The Vietnam War, Nuclear Bombs
in nation building in Southeast Asia, 1945 through 1961. Get your copy today at Amazon.com. Why? The Vietnam War by author Mike Swanson. Ochelli.com.
And the third segment of the Wednesday Ochelli Effect. Now, this is odd because normally on Thursday, I've got Mike Swanson with me, but today we're going to get a quick hit, so to speak, a quick run-by, drive-by, if you will, with Mike Swanson. And the first thing I got to ask him is if he was on Twitter today and all that. But WallStreetWindow.com, be in the know, go there. Also the books, The War State and Why the Vietnam War. He's the author of both of those and the author of actually quite a few books, but those are the two I focus on. Also a history of Danville, Virginia and all that. Books on money, which is stuff that I don't know much about. Although I just had on a guy who was a professor of finance at Ramapo who, you know, we spoke libertarian philosophy all the way around, totally unscripted. And, I think that went really well. Anyways, Murray Sabrin was the, first hour plus guest, but Mike Swanson's with me, man. How you doing tonight, Mike?
I'm doing good. How are you doing today?
I'm all right. You know, I know that you use social media sometimes, and I know you're on Twitter. You're at, I think, at Trader Mike. It'll be in the show notes, guys. If you don't know, go follow Mike Swanson if you're not already doing it. But I go on Twitter to, like, just see what's going on, and I tried to send out a retweet from somebody, and it told me I was at my limit for the day. So I go and I check what my limits are. It's 2,100 tweets is your limit, right? And I didn't tweet 2,100 times today, so I didn't know what was going on. Then I started getting messages from a bunch of different people I knew. What in the hell is wrong with Twitter? Apparently it told a lot of people they were at their limit, can't tweet, can't message, all that. Twitter's broken. So, remember when Facebook went down for a couple days, Mike? Everybody freaked out. Remember that? A few years ago?
Yeah. And then they learned they didn't need it. Then it came back. They needed it more than ever.
Of course.
I haven't been using Twitter today, but yesterday I was embedding a tweet on a post to my website, and it gave me a strange error, and it looked like the site was down. And then it came right back. So that was I've seen it slow down a couple, you know, ever since Musk bought it. I've seen it appear to slow down a bunch, but I haven't seen anything like what you're describing.
It is behaving strangely since Musk bought it, isn't it? It's not all normal. Now I'm wondering if I should buy my blue check mark. Did you buy
it? I'm not buying it.
No? Okay.
I just kind of look at it as a spy to find what financial people are saying. I don't post on it anymore because I just know when they make you buy the Twitter blue, if you don't buy it, no one's going to see what you write. And I don't want any part of it anymore.
Fair enough. And yet you're still on
in that sense.
And yet
Facebook is like that too. If you got a Facebook page, no one sees it unless you spend money on the ads.
Exactly. But you know what? I'm still over there. I'm still on Twitter too. I mean, I'm going to keep trying, and hope that someday, people will see my stuff again. But anyway, it is what it is. And that's not the only thing I ever want to talk to you about. But, you know, I got to say, what is on your mind today? Let me just get straight to it instead of running my mouth.
Well, I read John Newman's newest book, most of it, last week. It's called Uncovering Popoff's Mole. And I want to touch on something interesting in it that I read.
Okay.
And at the moment, I'm reading another book called The Kennedy Withdrawal, which may be worth talking more about next week after I finish it. But it's basically claiming that the withdrawal was a stunt or something created for politics, and Kennedy didn't really mean it. And so if he had lived, it's pretty much not important. It's basically an attack, I think, he doesn't name them in by name in the text of the book, but they're in the footnotes. It's an attack on Newman and Peter Dale Scott.
Really?
And he does talk about books influencing people's thoughts. So, and this guy's with the Miller Center, you know, too, that Carmine had written an article about some Miller Center guy that said there's nothing in the JFK files.
Yeah, well, interesting.
So it's kind of curious.
It is curious, and it's fascinating to me because I'm sure some years ago you read the book or saw the film Virtual JFK. You remember that?
Yeah, and there was a – I got the book, and this person that wrote this, I believe, was part of that.
Uh-huh.
You know, they had a collection of scholars that came together to discuss this topic. Now – well, I'll just get to what bothers me the most.
Sure.
About writing in general. And this guy isn't the only person that does this. I personally have a problem making claims of what Kennedy would have done if he had lived, because you know, it's a counterfactual. There's no way to be 100% sure. And also, I don't think, I think it's important enough just to know what he did before he died. And
see, now here's an interesting point of discussion, right? A lot of people talk about, and I even talk about what would have happened had he lived, right? And I'm under the belief that we would have withdrawn from Vietnam, but my belief is based on the fact that he had issued an order to do so. You see, I just see that as a hint at where it was going. Now, does that mean that potentially it could have been, you know, done for, temporarily, or there might have been another change of heart? You know, I mean, it's not as though American politicians have not flip-flopped on an issue literally, not just through rhetoric, but through their actions before, right? So it would not be an insane idea to say, look, he might have wanted to appear as though he was coming out and even came out of Vietnam and then returned to it. Or maybe the withdrawal would not have been completed. You know, et cetera, et cetera. You could speculate on this all day. But I see the order as a withdrawal as logically leading to us withdrawing by the end of 65. I mean,
no, I think you're correct. I just personally am not interested in. I'm contemplating writing another book and what topics I might write about.
Right.
And Newman's written a book all about this. You know, that makes that claim. The whole book's based on that. And this book here is like trying to refute it. And I'm not planning on writing a book based just around this argument. I'm not interested in it, but in doing that. But I think it's undeniable, and this person's not really denying it, that when Kennedy was president, the policy was that they were going to train the South Vietnamese, and it was a limited commitment, and it was scheduled to end
right
by 1965, and obviously he died, and the policy was changed.
Right.
And I think, you know, I haven't gotten to the point where he explains the change in the policy under LBJ. This book, he's got arguments about that, so I'm curious to see what he has to say. And there is always new information, and I've seen one or two things already that are new and interesting in this,
but you and I encountered this argument even when we were looking at that wholly boring documentary, right?
Oh gosh.
You know, that thing was putting both of us to sleep, and we're interested in the subject. You know, really bad. Ken Burns, God. The whole argument throughout that documentary was repeated like a mantra. Look, don't blame LBJ for Vietnam. You know, Kennedy started it, basically. And, you know, LBJ just had to kind of go along with it. You know, he was almost like a passenger, not responsible for setting policy, you know, so on and so forth. And I mean, that was the general message, as I remember, in the Ken Burns documentary over and over again. I mean, do you remember it the same way?
Yeah, and that was really kind of ridiculous.
It was.
It's facts. Kennedy died. I'm gonna put the facts out. I'm not gonna make a conclusion.
Sure, go ahead.
Kennedy died. NSAM, was it 273 was issued?
After his death, 273, yeah.
After his death. Now it was prepared before his death.
Yes.
Signed afterwards.
Yes.
But what I believe is more important than even that is within a day or two after the assassination, you know, the morning after the assassination, Jay has a phone call, as you know, with the FBI Director Hoover. Mm-hmm. Hoover tells him that they have evidence on Oswald, but the person that went to Mexico and said they're Oswald could be an imposter.
Right.
Well, after that phone call, he meets with John McCone and McGeorge Bundy, and he's shown evidence that we now know.
Yeah, John McCone. John McCone was the head of the CIA for the listeners at the time.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
He shows cables that they've gotten from, you know, CIA cables and so forth immediately after the assassination about Oswald having met a Cuban in Mexico City who a witness says gave him money. And this is a visit where he supposedly went to the Cuban and Soviet embassies and had a contact with the KGB officer in charge of assassinations, which Hoover told him the phone calls don't match Oswald's voice. He calls later at this embassy and it doesn't seem to be his voice. But regardless, we now know that within a week, the FBI debunks this story about Oswald getting money from a Cuban. They debunk it. The CIA then debunks it. But more importantly, soon within days after the assassination, LBJ has a meeting with Desmond Fitzgerald, I think McGeorge Bundy. It's like a National Security Council meeting.
Mm-hmm.
Fitzgerald is CIA, high up in the CIA, mid-level person, but he's overseeing in Washington their Cuban operations.
Right.
He's one of those people. And he tells them stuff, gives them an update of what's going on. And LBJ shoots down the idea of doing anything more with Cuba. We're not going to do anything. No more. He doesn't even want to hear it. You know, it's over. He basically tells him. And then he sends a memo to the Joint Chiefs of Staff telling them that the number one priority for foreign policy is victory in Vietnam.
Right.
Not helping the South Vietnamese build a country, or helping them train to, you know, take the war, you know, to win themselves, which is what the policy was when Kennedy died, but victory.
Right.
And it's the most important priority. You know, Kennedy never said that about Vietnam either. And what happens? Well, it does become the most important foreign policy issue, period.
Right.
From then on, until 1975. So, yeah, these are new policies. But again, and I've said this on your show, what everyone has ignored, and I don't blame Newman for ignoring it, because this was before his book came out, and it only bolsters his argument, I believe.
Mm-hmm.
But what all these people ignore is what was going on in Vietnam.
Mm-hmm.
What were the North Vietnamese doing? Well, we know now, unless he was lying, that because this is a statement General Giap said in the 90s, mm-hmm. that they thought Kennedy was going to withdraw.
Right.
You know, and that's what they thought.
Mm-hmm.
So what happens after Kennedy dies? Within 48 hours, the North Vietnamese make the decision to escalate the war by sending their first units of North Vietnamese combat troops into South Vietnam. Mm-hmm. They hadn't done that yet. They were only supporting the insurgents, the so-called VC.
Right.
But after Kennedy dies, within 48 hours, they make the decision that the United States is going to escalate, and we now must beat them to the escalation by sending people down and trying to win as quickly as we can.
Right.
And so would that have happened if Kennedy had lived? No one talks about that question, but anyway, the thing about what the argument, what this, and again, I want to see what he says at the end, about the change in the policy. I haven't gotten to that yet, but so far, the argument he's making against the Kennedy withdrawal is, that, look, McNamara designed it and presented it at a Honolulu conference in May 1962 for the first time. And Roswell Gilpatrick, who was Kennedy, McNamara's assistant secretary of defense, said that McNamara and Kennedy had planned this together and their plan was to withdraw. The Pentagon Papers say that Kennedy basically told McNamara, encouraged McNamara, told him to do this at this, before this meeting, you know, to present, but that goes against what the author is, wants to say in his thesis. So he says that that's not right, that there's no, documented evidence, of this. So the Pentagon Papers state it, but there's no memo, there's no order from Kennedy, so he doesn't think that's correct. And this, and he presents the withdrawal thing as McNamara's plan, not Kennedy's plan.
Hmm.
And I just don't, you know, that's going against, no one's saying, no one says that but this author. You know, Roswell Gilpatrick doesn't say that. McNamara doesn't say that. The Pentagon Papers doesn't say that. This author says that because he has to say that in order to make his argument. So that's what I think of this book, I guess.
What documentation does he have to back that up? That there's no, you know, is he, I don't know. I don't know. Look, maybe he's got some kind of zinger in there that we don't know about. I mean, it's possible.
Yeah, maybe it's later on in the book.
But, right? I mean, really, it sounds to me like I'm just going to ignore, you know, what goes against my argument. And we've seen that before in literature, for sure. But it seems to me logical. I mean, you can argue all day about what might have changed. But, like you said, the facts are the facts. And this is what it was when it was. And after his death, things changed. I have offered the question a few times, and nobody's got a great answer for me, but I'll just throw it on the table with you here right now. You know, do you think the abandonment of the Cuba issue had anything to do with the fact that Bobby Kennedy was deeply involved in it? And, I mean, you know, Johnson didn't want to really keep Bobby Kennedy as Attorney General. You know, or maybe involved in the government at all, because they were famously at each other's throats all the time, right? I mean, mm-hmm. you know, it, could it be that since that was simply Bobby's project, you know, in his mind, well, to hell with it. I mean, I would not put that kind of just very short thinking past Johnson, you know? And we do know that Bobby was well involved with the Cuba project, right? So, I don't know, man. There's a lot of open questions, but I don't get it when somebody wants to refute this idea. I really don't. But look, if new evidence emerges that backs it up, what can I say? But it doesn't make a whole lot of sense to me. I mean, it doesn't seem to make a lot of sense to you either, Mike. I mean, I'm just saying.
No, it does. It really doesn't.
Okay. Well, you know, again, who knows? Maybe he's got something there that I have never seen, but I just don't get it. I don't. Anyway, look, I realize that, you know, that this is something you're reading on. I haven't read Newman's new book. I gotta, you know, full disclosure there. I haven't read it yet, and I certainly haven't read this guy's book.
Well, you're probably not gonna read it. This Kennedy withdrawal book. It's after what I'm telling you.
Well, no, but that's not true. See, now, if he's got something in there,
you know,
I mean, frankly, if you tell me, look, he actually makes a compelling argument about some of this, I may be tempted to see it. Look, I'm not opposed to looking at something that, you know, doesn't necessarily make sense right away. Because it could be that I'm just not well informed enough to know that it does. I can accept that. I mean, I got to tell you, when I went on Coast to Coast AM and I called in and got that guy who was trying to claim that, you know, it was DM's brother there, that his wife is the one who arranged for Kennedy to be assassinated, you know. I mean, that's just a ridiculous claim. I mean, you know, it's as payback for her husband's murder, she sent somebody to dispatch Kennedy. I mean, you know, how ridiculous you want to get. You know, when I hear stuff like that, I mean, look, I'm not going to bother reading whatever the hell that guy had out. I don't know if it was a website or a book or whatever, but who cares? It's stupid. You know, have you ever heard of that one, by the way?
No, I've heard it, but I didn't know who said it or where, you know, if anyone's written a book about it. That's,
well,
to me, it's just like something thrown out there, you know?
Yeah, I don't remember if the guy was promoting a book or whatever, but I will tell you, it was the 2012 Coast to Coast AM JFK special.
Oh, okay.
So, and in fact, you can hear the first phone caller on there where I started to tell this guy how ridiculous his claim was, and then they turned me down and let the guy yell at me. So I'm still talking. The guy can't hear me, and neither can the audience. I heard the podcast once a while ago, and it's really ridiculous sounding. It's like I just start to challenge the guy, and they turn me down. And that's what happened. I was the first caller on the show. But it was like, come on, man. Really? This is what I was calling in thinking that I would talk to Diogenio, actually, who was, I think, the planned second hour guest or something that night.
Oh, okay.
But I call in, I get this guy, and I'm telling you, it was like, I don't know if you got a book or if you've just been hit in the head, dude, but whatever it is, I don't know where you're getting this from. And I don't know, maybe I'll conclude the same thing if I look at this book that you're talking about. Did you buy a physical copy of that book?
Oh, yeah, I got a physical copy.
Okay, yeah, well, you know, that's the kind of thing you and I both tend to do. I did get in the mail today Robert Groden's book, Absolute Proof. I got that in the mail today. But
great.
Yeah, I haven't gotten a chance to look all the way through it, but I was just happy to see it show up. So, you know, and look, it's that's photographic evidence and stuff I can look at, you know, at a later time. I'm going to take a look at it. I've been wanting that book for years. So, kind of glad that I got a hold of it. But, I don't know. Maybe I will ask you about this other book and see.
Well, if there's more, yeah, I'll have read it by the next time we talk the whole thing. So,
right.
You know, maybe there's tidbits in it that are interesting. And, there's things about, the pilot, you know, there's things that I don't think people are fully understand about a lot of this stuff yet. So,
and you think
he does
you think he does a good job showing you some of those things?
Well, I'm not sure. I want to see what he has to say about
okay.
The NSAM 277, 273, and some of these things about when Johnson takes over. Mm-hmm. But one of the problems I have with the way this guy's writing, and he's not the only one that writes like this, mm-hmm. but I was taught when I was in college, it's a horrible way to write or a thing to do. I always thought I was a good writer, and one of the professors I had ripped one of my papers apart and said, don't use the word, avoid using the word was as much as you can, and it'll read better. And that was something I learned. But then the other thing someone told me is really try to avoid saying, writing sentences where you say what people are thinking. Because you don't really know. In fact, it might be Walt Brown, actually, who told me that. But somebody did it a long time ago.
Right.
Don't write things saying this person thinks this. And I don't do that in my books. I try to make it really clear when I'm speculating that someone is thinking something.
No, you do an excellent job.
And I rarely do that.
Yeah, no, you do an excellent job in your books. This is why I love your book, and why I was talking about your book before I ever had you on the show, is because it was so plainly and cleanly explained, everything in it, that it was like perfect. It was like a good way to not get us, you know, all tied up in things like what people think. You know, if somebody said it, and you have a way of verifying they said it, that's one thing. But as opposed to, you know, what's in somebody's mind, the truth is, Mike, whether it's your wife or it's the guy down the street that you buy your newspaper from, it doesn't matter. You don't know what's in anybody's mind.
Yeah, it's hard to know what's in your own.
You know, it's hard to know what's exactly. That was my next point. You stole the punchline. That's okay, though. It's hard to know what's in your own mind sometimes, right? So you claim to be, are you a psychic? You know, I remember being admonished like that too, about, you know, speaking about somebody thinking, and maybe it was Walt who did it. You know, I mean, you can question, you can ask, I wonder what somebody was thinking, but to state it is a bad thing, because truth is, even if they told you something, it doesn't mean they told you what's actually on their mind. You know, people lie, right, Dr. House? You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It's just, it is one of those things. So, look, I know we have a very short segment here to deal with, and this is you being on the show much later than normal, so I don't want to hold you up too long, but this was an interesting and unexpected discussion I didn't expect. And the reason why I have Mike on tonight is because he won't be available to me tomorrow. So it's very good to have you on tonight, and really, I'm very happy you brought this up. Is there anything else you want to get to before I let you go, though?
Yeah, I want to throw one little tidbit that's in this Newman book, and like the thing about the Newman book, I don't have the knowledge or the expertise to have firm opinions on these moles and the big issues that he's writing about.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tough subject. He's got tidbits of stuff from the files.
Mm-hmm.
And he's got this chapter in here about Oswald. When he defected to the Soviet Union, he was working in a factory in Minsk.
Right.
The Soviets put him up in a really nice apartment. And, this is new to me. Maybe you know this, but I don't. The ARB discovered that there was a new Soviet defector that I never heard of. Hmm. He defected in 1991, and he walked into a CIA station, and he made claims about Oswald and the assassination, and they're crazy. He claimed that Oswald was conspiring to assassinate two other presidents before Kennedy. It was nonsense. But the CIA wrote a report on this guy, and it said that we have information from codename IJ Decanter, which disproves what this guy's saying. And it outlines Oswald and his wife's KGB connections and denies any KGB involvement in dispatching Oswald to assassinate Kennedy.
Mm-hmm.
For your background, information on IJ Decanter was a second chief directorate officer whose bona fides were fully established.
Mm-hmm.
What this is indicating is that there's another defector named IJ Decanter who claim to have this information about Oswald, and that they confirmed his bona fides. Mm. So this was legitimate information, and the ARB then spent time trying to track down this story, and they were able to find out the name of this defector, Papushkin, and he worked. He became an FBI informant and a CIA informant. Mm-hmm. And he did. He was exact. You know, he was a major in the second chief directorate intelligence, counterintelligence. Mm-hmm. And he came to the United States, became a defector. And he claimed that he knew people at the Minsk KGB school. Mm-hmm. So Oswald was in Minsk near this KGB school. In fact, the KGB school was on the same street as the apartment he was living in. And this guy claimed that the people in the KGB, running this KGB school, mm-hmm. he knew them, and they told him, like, in drinks or whatnot, that Oswald was sent to Minsk so he could be under their watch.
Yeah.
And they spied on him, and they said, in this guy's words, that they considered him an agent. But that doesn't mean an agent like one may think, like James Bond or something. They just called him an agent because he would willingly talk to them mm-hmm. and give them information. So he was a source, an informant, and they were puffing him up. As this guy was explaining it.
Yeah.
Calling him an agent to make it sound like they really got something. You know, we got this guy mm-hmm. as their agent. You make it look like they're doing something really important. However, it says they also considered Marina as an agent, and she was, according to this defector, mm-hmm. A swallow whose job was to seduce Oswald and go to the United States and, you know, continue to work for them. Mm-hmm. Now, he says that these people in this KGB school told him that Oswald fell in love with her, and she was interested in him and also really wanted to get out of the Soviet Union. Mm-hmm. And obviously they do that. They come to the United States. Mm-hmm. And then she, once the two came to the United States, she never helped them ever again, never, you know, just ignore anything, just, didn't do nothing. And, he also claimed, oh, there's another source that the CIA had, a Colonel Yershak, that the CIA got information on, who worked at the school, who said all the same stuff that the other person did, and added, and I'm looking at this from quotations in the Newman's Book of Files, you know, he's quoting from, that they had a low opinion of Oswald. He was, in their view, a bit crazy, unpredictable. He was never required to sign an agreement to cooperate, even though he was cooperating.
Right.
And they believed Oswald knew he was in contact with the KGB.
Well, that all sounds believable based on other things I've read.
Yeah.
To be honest with you. And some of it, yeah, I'm familiar with from other places. You know, Ernst Titovitz would be one of those places.
Yeah.
You're well aware of that book and that individual. And there's a guy who, yeah, and clearly tells the story. The only odd thing here is that Oswald falls in love more than once in Minsk. You know,
that's true. That's true. Forgot about that.
Yeah, he asks Ella German to marry him, right? Before Marina. So it's a very strange tale, his time over there. But the idea that the KGB was watching him and that he knew the KGB was watching him, I would not be surprised there. I think they made it fairly obvious. And they covertly, according to more than one source, went around to, you know, regular people that were there and were having meetings with them, the KGB officers in the area, including the people that you're talking about here, were meeting with his neighbors, his friends. If he went to go interact with a girl, they'd meet with this with that girl's family. Oh, the whole bit. The whole time he was there. So,
well, one thing I want to tell you.
Yeah.
Jefferson Morley's been doing these podcasts. Mm-hmm. I think you got to pay for them, but
okay.
He did one of Ernst Titovitz, and I listened to that. And he was hanging out with Oswald a lot.
Right.
They were friends. And after the assassination, Morley asked him, did he think Oswald did it? And he just didn't think so.
Right.
But he made an interesting comment. He said none of the people that he knew in the Soviet Union that knew Oswald, interacted with him at all, thought he did it.
Yeah.
In fact, he said they didn't think he was capable of killing somebody.
Right.
And to me, that's a real interesting statement. That's real interesting because unfortunately, I know of two people that have killed people. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I was thinking about that when I was hearing this. And I was like, well, I wouldn't have said that about them before they did it, even though I wasn't thinking they were going to do something like that, you know?
Mm. No, I get it. There's a big difference between saying, I don't believe somebody's capable of it. And, well, after it happens, you go, well, all right, I'm not all that surprised, you know, if it happens. And no, I've heard that before, too. I don't remember if he said that during an interview with me or not, Titovitz.
Mm.
But you heard me interview him, right?
I'm sure I have. It's just been...
It's probably been some
couple
years
ago, you know?
Yeah, I'll see if I can dig it up for you. But I know I have it. I mean, I'm going to be going through my archives very soon. So when I come across it, I'll give it to you. It's a fairly lengthy interview. And, it's one of the early ones I did, actually, with this show. But, it is interesting to me, exactly how he viewed Oswald, and the character of him and everything. And to me, you know, Titovitz was just a kid who was really wanting to tape Oswald so that he could, examine the way he spoke English from a native speaker's point of view because he was learning English. But they also became friends and continued to be friends. And, you know, Titovitz even wrote to him after he came back here and stuff like that. You know, I'm just saying, it's a very interesting thing there. And his point of view on him, I think, is unique and sadly is often ignored by people that put together these, you know, profiles, if you will. Of Oswald, these psychological profiles, which I think are almost always incorrect. You know what I mean? So, anyway, with that in mind, Mike Swanson, WallStreetWindow.com. I'm sure, you know, you'll be back next week, though, right, on the show?
Yeah, I'll be here on the regular day next week, Thursday.
Excellent.
Yeah.
So we'll have him on Thursday, everybody. And until then, look, I want to thank Murray Sabrin for joining me in the first hour. Be in the know. Go to WallStreetWindow.com. I'll give you guys links to Mike Swanson's stuff in the show notes along with Murray Sabrin's, and that's that for tonight. So no matter who you are, where you are, when you are, I am Emilio Ocelli, and all of you are indeed the effect. Good night.